morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new report says wars in Sudan, Gaza, and the DRC have displaced a record 76 million people.
Conflict and violence have driven the number of internally displaced people around the world to a new record, according to a new report from the Geneva-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center.
Over 25 million people across Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad are trapped in a spiral of deteriorating food security. Campaigning is in full swing, with 2 weeks left before South Africa's May 29th election. A new TB vaccine is to be tested in South Africa. An international court reassures Uganda's LRA victims on reparations. Uganda signs an EGA protocol guaranteeing the free movement of goods and people.
A free movement regime would facilitate higher volume of regional trade, improved access to basic social services, as well as improved governance of the rural areas.
A UN official assesses the impact of El Nino on Malawians and assures help. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Conflict has forced a record number of people around the world to become internally displaced, forced to flee their homes, but still living in their home countries, often in refugee camps. As Henry Ritual reports, the figure has increased dramatically in the past 5 years.
In recent months, thousands of people have arrived at the Bulengo camp for internally displaced people near Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. They have fled fighting between the Congolese army and M23 rebel groups. Faida Bauma arrived with her 4 children. Look at the conditions in which we live, Bauma says. When it rains here, we suffer. Look at where we sleep. When it rains, we have to fold our mattresses. We are going to die here, she says. People are even raped. Conflict and violence have driven the number of internally displaced people around the world to a new record, according to a new report from the Geneva-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. Almost half live in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 76 million people globally were forced to flee their homes in 2023 and are living elsewhere in their own countries, many in camps or makeshift accommodation. That's an increase of almost 50% over the past 5 years. Ivana Hajmanova is a co-author of the report.
Half of this figure comes from just 5 countries, including Sudan, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Colombia, Yemen, and Syria. These countries are usually not visible in the media headlines.
Sudan has the largest internally displaced population in the world at more than 9 million people. Most were forced to flee their homes after the latest civil conflict erupted in April 2023. Again, Ivana Hajmanova.
Many of them have been forced to move multiple times. So we saw families moving away from Khartoum, going to the Darfur regions, moving all across the country. And of course, we are very concerned about their needs and their vulnerabilities, because with each new displacement, their resilience reduces.
Some 4 out of every 5 Palestinians have been forced to flee their homes in the Gaza Strip because of the conflict between Israel and Hamas, according to the report's authors. With borders closed, most have nowhere safe to go. Ivana Hajmanova.
Recent UN estimates point out to the fact that it will take around 80 years to rebuild everything which had been destroyed in the Gaza Strip. And this shows that it might be that most of the people who are currently living in Gaza and who have been displaced won't see their houses rebuilt during their lifetime.
Close to 8 million internally displaced people were forced to flee because of natural disasters. The February 2023 earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria triggered 4.7 million displacements. Cyclone Freddy, which hit southern Africa in February and March last year, forced 1.4 million people to become displaced. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Over 25 million people across the Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad are trapped in a spiral of deteriorating food security, with at least 17 million in Sudan. The World Food Programme says the war in Sudan is creating the world's largest hunger crisis, and warring parties in Sudan are preventing aid from reaching people. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Mati Devu, advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council, about the humanitarian crisis in Sudan and the looming famine.
The humanitarian situation is really worsening by the day. Right now, there's a conflict escalation in Darfur, and probably what is going to be one of the most horrific and biggest battle of Darfur is currently happening in Al-Fashir, where there is millions of people basically trapped, people who are hungry, people who have no access to basic services. And, you know, over the weekend, there's been fighting in the streets, heavy artillery, airstrikes, even hitting a hospital, a pediatric hospital. So this is in Darfur, but across the country, there is clashes. There are people hungry, people fleeing, and every week is worse than the other.
And one of the biggest problems is getting the aid to the people. And it appears that the warring parties are not allowing the humanitarian organizations to do this. So why are they stopping the flow of aid?
Yes, humanitarian access and humanitarian space is completely obstructed by parties to the conflict. We're not able to bring assistance from one side of the country to the other. We're facing a lot of restriction all across. And really, the people who are suffering the most are the civilians that have been waiting for food aid, cash assistance, medical aid, shelter, and they've just left with themselves. The only people that manage to reach them are the people that are already there. For example, local respondents who are in conflict zone and who are running, you know, small soup kitchens, small shelters, small medical facilities that are able to support, but this is really a drop in the ocean compared to what is needed. As to why those obstructions are happening, I have no idea. What I know is that this is against international humanitarian law. And frankly, it's against like every single aspect of humanity when you have an entire country that is facing such a catastrophic level of suffering and of hunger.
Mathilde Vu is the advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was speaking with viewers Kim Lewis. Uganda has signed a protocol that allows the free movement of people in the regional bloc, the Intergovernmental Authority for Development, or IGAD. Officials said the move will boost regional trade and business among member countries. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarinji has more from Kampala, Uganda.
IGAD's executive secretary, Wokini Gebeyahu, says the free movement of persons and property will greatly benefit its peoples. He says member states will benefit from labor mobility and shared investments.
A free movement regime will facilitate higher volume of regional trade, improved access to basic social services, access by governments to unreached marginal communities, as well as improved governance of the rural areas.
Five member countries, notably Sudan, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and now Uganda, have signed a protocol covering a combined population of about 300 million people. Gebeyahu says people's movements should not be restricted in a region beset by various problems.
We confront challenges of fragility in IGAD region arising from natural disasters, drought, floods, mudslides, landslides, desert locusts, a lot of things, and a conflict which is happening in our region.
J.J. Odongo is Uganda's Minister of Foreign Affairs, who signed on behalf of his country. He said the protocol was long overdue.
It is useless for us to exist as an organization if we are not free to be part of that organization in each and every corner of that organization.
Kenya and Djibouti are the only remaining IGAD member countries yet to sign the document. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 15th, and for more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In just 2 weeks, South Africans will vote in a national election on May 29th. Many analysts say there is a sense of an unprecedented uncertainty about the outcome, as polls suggest the ruling African National Congress, ANC, will lose its majority after 30 years in power, as political parties vie for voters' attention in the last 2 weeks of campaigning. A coalition government looks like a possibility for the first time since the end of apartheid. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached Sulema Mugula, a Durban-based political analyst, for his take on the campaign.
Really, people are well mobilized. The competition is real. As you know, South Africans are well politicized, and the coming in of former President Zuma with his MK party has also boosted the campaigns. Otherwise, the ANC, the major parties, they are full swing. The DA, Democratic Alliance, the EFF, all of them are active. The Inkatha Freedom Party, they are all active on the ground, and they are campaigning very well. South Africa is a well-organized democracy, so there is no hindrance at all. You can't see any soldiers, unlike in other African countries. Here, it is real campaigning, and really people are looking forward to the day, to the 29th of May, for voting.
Yes, just in under 2 weeks. What are the main issues that are of contention in these campaigns?
Basically, it is service delivery. People want service, they want water, they want better education, they want good health services, they want security, especially security. There is a lot of insecurity which is cropping up, a lot of gang violence, so people want a real solution to their problems. And then also poverty and unemployment for the youth. Those are the major issues, real issues which concern the people. And that is what the political party are trying to address, each one of them promising to do better than the ANC if elected into power.
Talking of ANC, how threatened is ANC since it's been in power all this time?
Yes, there are pockets of upsurge of opposition parties, but basically the ANC has a track record. Having been in power for all this long, it has had a lot of achievement. Actually, even what you call failures are a result of their successes. Because they have achieved, people are demanding more, and they are trying to say that they have not provided. Actually, they have provided. They have been able to expand education. They have been able to provide for the youth to provide bursaries for higher education, for free education in the lower primary, the health services, people are able, the hospitals are operating, the ambulance services are operating. So the health sector is not bad. As you saw, they were able to hold the country together during COVID. The education system was able to move. The health services were able to manage the pandemic. And remember, because of the threat from the other political parties, they brought up their old guns. Former President Mbeki has been campaigning. Mokhtanteka has been campaigning. Former Vice President Mabuza has been campaigning. So they have got the big guns campaigning.
That was political analyst Sulema Mugula, a Durban-based South African, speaking with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. A groundbreaking clinical trial is underway in South Africa, marking a pivotal movement in the fight against tuberculosis. The new vaccine could potentially become the first to help prevent pulmonary TB in adolescents and adults, the most common form of the disease, and the first new TB vaccine in more than a century. Zahia Kasim has the story.
Tuberculosis is one of the deadliest diseases globally. It's the main cause of death for people with HIV virus that causes AIDS and kills about 1.5 million annually, despite being curable and treatable. Dr. Nompumelelo Mothupa is at the forefront of this battle. She oversees the TB unit at a prominent government hospital in Johannesburg. She confronts the harsh reality that many individuals in South Africa die with TB because they do not receive timely treatment or continue with the prescribed medication. The new M72 vaccine trial offers renewed optimism for curbing the prevalence of TB.
We want to end TB, but we don't have much. Even drugs that are being developed for TB, we've got very few drugs that are developed for TB per period of time. This vaccine is going to help quite a lot.
In many parts of South Africa, testing is done in mobile clinics like this. The vaccine works with people who have latent TB. This is when the infection is in the body, but the individual does not feel sick and cannot spread the disease. TB only becomes active if the immune system weakens, so it is dangerous when immunity is compromised, such as for HIV or AIDS patients. The M72 vaccine trial, headed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Medical Research Institute and the Wellcome Trust, represents a collaborative effort involving up to 20,000 participants. The study includes 60 sites globally, with 32 sites in South Africa. Dr. Emilio Emini from the Bill and Melinda Gates Medical Research Institute.
But there's also an epidemiological benefit as well, because TB is primarily transmitted from individuals who have, in fact, active tuberculosis. So by lessening the overall number of individuals in a population, particularly in a population with a high burden of latent TB who have active tuberculosis, that in turn will prevent the further transmission of the infection to other individuals who are not already infected and prevent them from becoming infected.
Experts agree that the only way to put a dent in TB rates is by testing, like this clinic, and by creating a vaccine that works for adolescents and adults. Experts say the M72 vaccine offers great promise with this demographic. A 50% efficacy rate could save 8.5 million lives and prevent 76 million new cases, according to the World Health Organization. Zeki Kasim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
An official of the International Criminal Court has promised the victims of Uganda's Rebel Laws Resistance Army that the court will provide reparations that were promised after the conviction of a top LRA leader. However, the Tribunal Trust Fund does not have enough money to make the payments, and now some victims worry the other conflicts are drawing down donor funds. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
ICC Registrar Osvaldo Zavala Gila, speaking to the media Tuesday in Uganda, assured victims of the violent, long-running LRA rebellion that the court would do as much as possible to ensure victims get their reparations. In February, ICC judges ordered $56 million in reparations to recognize the harm suffered by 50,000 victims of war crimes for which Dominic Ongwen has been convicted. Those include murder, rape, forced marriage, and the recruitment of child soldiers. Gila's comment comes despite Ongwen's appeal of his conviction. Gila says while the appeal is still pending, the ICC will continue efforts to raise funds to pay the reparations and comply with the court order. He also indicated not all victims would receive payments at the same time.
And that will depend on the fundraising efforts of the trust fund to do this. I am confident that there is enough interest in the international donor-based community to support the effort of the trust fund in trying to achieve its goals.
Speaking to VOA before meeting the ICC registrar, Bishop Nelson Onono Onweng, a community leader from Gulu District, said what he is hearing from the ICC is worrying. Bishop Onono says the promised $795 per person allocation for the 50,000 victims is too little, yet the ICC has no money.
So if it comes now, it will be great, but we are told they are still raising the money. Fundraising today, as you know, with the war in the world, I don't know. But personally, I'm worried because the international community is now overwhelmed with the needs in the world to support the suffering people.
Peter Labeja, a journalist from Gulu District, lost his father during the 20-year rebellion. He was also abducted but was lucky to escape. Labeja tells VOA victims still have questions on how the money will be shared.
Who is going to take the money? Is it the head of the family taking the money or the entire group in the household taking the money? And we were quick to calculate to say this is about 3 million shillings in Uganda. What can 3 million shillings do? It can't even send a child to the university for 2 semesters.
The community remains hopeful that the communal reparation will be used to build schools and health facilities and improve roads. Victims will have to wait until September, not for the money, but for the ICC to prepare the implementation plan now being developed. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The United Nations is pledging to help Malawi recover from a widespread drought linked to the El Nino climate pattern. Government officials said the crisis has created a food shortage for nearly half of the country's population. The pledge comes after UN officials visited Malawi to see the damage firsthand and identify ways to offer support. Lamek Masina has more from southern Malawi.
The UN is pledging to help drought-stricken Malawi after officials this month traveled to the country's Chikwawa district, one of the worst-hit areas. Officials say they went to see the damage for themselves and speak to local residents, including farmers like Mary Agambani, about how the drought has affected them.
We have a 2-acre maize crop. We usually harvest 15 to 30 bags, weighing 50 kilograms each. And last year, we even harvested 50 bags. But this year, we have harvested nothing because all the maize
went. Agriculture officials in Malawi say nearly 9 million people currently face food shortages. The UN team described the situation in Malawi as dire.
I've met with mothers who are struggling to put food on the table for their children. I've met with farmers who are telling me that they've never seen a drought like this and have not been able to harvest anything at all this year. I'm also seeing the activities of the governments and the partners.
Gerani says the team would lobby for more funds to help Malawi and other affected countries to mitigate the impact of climate change.
We are advocating for emergency funding to come to support the communities, but also these are the countries that are on the front line of the climate crisis. They have done the least to create it, and yet they are facing the hardest impact of it. So the financing, the climate financing that's available and has been pledged, needs to start coming to these affected countries so that communities can adapt to the new reality.
In March, Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera launched an international appeal of $200 million for food aid. UN officials also called for help.
I call upon all partners to actually avail the resources that the government needs. First, to allow the government to import food, but now, not wait. Second, actually push and help for the winter cropping, because this country does have water, does have opportunities, it doesn't have resources.
The Malawi government says it is taking steps to mitigate the impact.
We still think using some irrigation and residue moisture that is currently we can still do some production using irrigation farming and that other thing. So that's another area that we want. But we are also mindful of the fact that a lot of people don't have food, and therefore we have another component of humanitarian assistance. And in that component, we are looking at two aspects, providing some food to the people or some cash transfers.
As officials review ways to help, Malawians face the harsh realities of severe climate events like this one. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Chikwawa District, Malawi.
And that's it for this Wednesday, May 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.